Okay, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Daniel. We left off in chapter 11. And for those of you who weren't here last week, I was just commenting last week about how chapter 11 in the book of Daniel is probably one of the most difficult chapters in the entire Bible, because there's so much in it that's on the surface is dry, it's boring, it's monotonous, it's tedious when you're reading it. And it's very difficult to make heads or tails out of it, because this angel that appeared to Daniel and begins to interpret to him, tell him what's going to take place in the future. Well, for about the first 35, 34 verses of this chapter 11, almost everything that the angel predicted to come to pass came to pass within the next 300 or 400 years. Everything's already been completed. But then there's a big gap where it picks up in around verse 35, where it now, the angel begins to foretell what's going to take place in the end times. And that really has a great deal of relevance for us. But I think what we read in chapter 11, as far as up to verse 35, I mean, even though it was difficult to piece it all together, because there was the kings of the north and the kings of the south, which basically was Syria and Egypt, always back and forth. One succeeding king after another would be in warring against each other, and Israel would be caught in the middle, because they would always be going up and back and forth, you know, in all of their different wars and all of their intrigue and all of the exchanging of power and things like this. Well, now we're catapulted into the end, because now we're going to be dealing with the Antichrist of the New Testament. If you remember when we read last week, we read about the Antichrist of the Old Testament, which was Antiochus Epiphanes, who ruled around 175 BC, and he was just a cruel, merciless tyrant that typified the Antichrist that's going to come. And as a matter of fact, he so typified him that he, if you have an opportunity, read the first and second book of Maccabees. Even though it's not in the Protestant Bible, you will find it in the Catholic Bible. And it everything in there is so historical and so right on. As a matter of fact, it's when Antiochus Epiphanes set up that desecration, the abomination of desolation in the temple, he set up a statue of Jupiter. And he declared himself as being God or equal with God. And then he sacrificed a sow, a pig, on the altar of God. He was just a blasphemous man. And he was ended up with the Lord slaying him with a bowel disease. And he met a terrible end. But I think the significance is that what he did as far as the desecration of, you know, of the temple in the Old Testament, it prefigures what's coming in the New Testament. And as a matter of fact, when the Maccabees finally subdued his armies and put him on the run, they cleansed the temple and they started reinstituting their animal sacrifices. Well, if you remember back in Exodus, they had specific instructions as far as the oil for the lamps. It had to be made a certain way, and they only had enough oil to last one day when they dedicated the temple. And so when the Maccabees and the Jewish people who, you know, rededicated the temple, they lit the candles, but they only had enough oil for one day. Well, it lasted for 8 days until they had enough oil to, you know, continue to keep that lamp lit. That's why the Jews celebrate Hanukkah. This at the same time that we celebrate Christmas. For them, it's an 8-day celebration, because the candle kept burning for 8 days. On one day's worth of oil. I just mentioned that in passing because of the time of the year we're in and because we're dealing with this Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, let's pick up with this verse 35 of chapter 11. Let's back up just a little bit. As a matter of fact, let's start from verse 30, okay? It says, "For the ships of Kittim will come against him, against Antiochus Epiphanes. Therefore, he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant." The ships of Kittim, they were actually the Romans. And there was an alliance that was made with Israel and Rome. And then Rome came down to confront Antiochus and his armies, the Syrian armies, and then Antiochus, you know, backed off, and then the ships of Kittim or the Romans left. And when they left, this is what he said in verse 31, "And the forces for him will arise and desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with the regular sacrifices, and they will set up an abomination of desolations." That's what Antiochus did after the Romans had left. He went through Israel and with his intent to make a great slaughter, and then he defiles the altar of God and the sanctuary of God, and that was the abomination of desolations of the Old Testament. And verse 32, it says, and by smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly towards the covenant, but people who know their God will display strength and take action. Mm-hmm. Now, remember, when we're reading about this guy, he's a prefigurement of what's coming. What's coming upon the scene is going to be a world leader who's going to be a smooth talker. He's going to be an orator. He's going to sway people with his influence and his power and his charisma. He's going to be able to just dupe a multitude of people. And this is exactly what took place in the Old Testament. In verse 33, and those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by plunder for many days. Now, when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. And some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end times, because it is still to come at the appointed time. When we read about all these different wars, everything that was going on, it does get confusing. But what you see here is, just to steal it down into its essence, is this. War is a punishment from God. Right now, there's over 40 wars going on throughout the world right now. Men are killing each other left and right. It's one of Satan's greatest enterprises to get men at each other's throats. And I don't care whether it's, you know, in a marriage where husband and wives are at each other's throat, or whether it's nations at each other's throats. We are told in the scriptures that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but these principalities of wickedness, these forces of evil, these demonic forces that are, you know, in heavenly places. They are the ones who are constantly stirring up men to slay one another, to argue with one another, to quarrel with one another, you know, to fight with one another. This is what they do best. And this is what I think what is being said here. But why does God allow that to happen? God will allow it to happen to do what? He says here, to refine and purge and make them pure until the end time, because it is to come at the appointed time. In other words, this suffering through wars and everything that follows on its heels, whether it be disease or famine or, you know, all these type of things, it has a purging effect, a refining effect upon men. Just like what happened on September 11th. Unfortunately, we as a nation haven't changed, haven't repented, but it was a wake-up call where a lot of people, began to turn to God. Mm-hmm. And the worse things get, the more men begin to turn to God. And the easier they have it, it seems like the easier men forget God. Well, this is what God will allow to happen, especially in the end days, in the end times, under the Antichrist. There'll be tremendous suffering and tremendous death and tribulation and distress. But God in His mercy will allow that to happen to try to get men to turn to Him in repentance. Okay, so now we get beginning with verse 36. Okay, because now we basically have ended with Antiochus Epiphanes. Now there's a tremendous lapse of time. There's about 2,200 years lapse of time, because it brings us up to today. And I think that today we are standing at the very threshold of the coming of the next Antichrist, the ultimate Antichrist. Beginning with that verse 36, then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that is which decrees which will be done. And he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers, or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god. He will magnify himself above all of them. And that's exactly what Paul tells us in the New Testament. And as far as the Antichrist, he says that in verse 36 here that we just read in Daniel, a king will arise, he will do what he pleases, he will exalt himself and magnify himself above every god and speak monstrous things against the God of gods. Well, in Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul tells us that this is exactly what he's going to be like. Mm-hmm. He says, and then that lawless one, the Antichrist, will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one who is coming in accordance with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deceptions of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. And for this reason, God is going to allow them a great deception. But he tells us very plainly that he's going to you know, set himself up as being God, that he is going to exalt himself above all gods. And it says here in that verse, in verse 37, it says, he will show no regard for the gods of his father. And his God of the father is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then he says something that kind of, I think, ambiguous in the way it's worded. It says that he will show no regard for the gods of his father or for the desire of women. Now, here's a suggestion here. It's suggested through this verse, and I could be wrong, and I don't want to read in too much into it, that the Antichrist will be a homosexual. He has no desire for women. But the way it's worded, it says, or for the desire of women. Okay, now there could be a couple ways to interpret that. The Antichrist could be so consumed with power and prestige and pursuing his ambition that he has no desire for women, or that he has no time for them, whatever. Okay, that could be the application, all right? It could mean this too, that he shows no concern for women. In other words, he has no tenderness in his heart, no compassion in his heart for women or for children. He shows no regard for them. Okay, that could be an interpretation. This man is so self-willed that he's going to do what he wants and what he pleases. And the world's going to follow him. The world's going to think, this is great. Anyway, like I said, that's kind of ambiguous, so I don't want to be dogmatic about it. It's just a suggestion here in that verse 37. He says, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. That's exactly what we're told that he will do in Thessalonians. And verse 38 says, but instead he will honor a god of fortress, and a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold and silver and costly stones and treasures. And he will take action against the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign god, and he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and he will cause them to rule over the many, and will parcel out land for a price. In other words, it's saying that this man, his god is going to be a god of power, of might, of fortress. It's talking about that he will build up a military and a navy and a parliament and a police state that will be unrivaled by anything in history. Anything that Nazis had, that the Soviets had, power is going to be everything to him. And he's going to have everything at his disposal as far as having control over the resources and the wealth. It says here he'll parcel out land for a price. In other words, he's going to basically own everything. The government will own everything. If you want to buy a parcel of land, I mean, you have to go through the government. And the government is the Antichrist. I mean, that's the way it's going to get in the end of times. And it says here in verse 40, it says, at the end of time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he will enter into countries and overflow them and pass through. And he will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom and Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. And he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. So it says that at the end times, this is what we're dealing with now. We're not dealing with what happened prior to Christ's coming. We're dealing with the end times. He says the king of the south. The king of the south, we mentioned before, is Egypt. The king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots. Well, I don't think that this is the Battle of Armageddon. The reason I say that is because the Battle of Armageddon is going to be the Western forces of the world colliding with the Eastern forces of the world right down there in Jerusalem. But if you remember, when we went through Ezekiel chapter 38, 39, we are told that from the north, which is Gog, Magog, which is modern-day Russia, that's the northern army. They will come down and collide with him along with, it says, the king of the south. Well, if you read in Ezekiel 38:39, it mentions all of these different Arab nations are going to go up with Russia against Israel, but that's going to be at the very beginning of the tribulation period. Russia will be wiped out, all but one-sixth of the Russian army will be wiped out down there in the mountains of Israel. That will trigger off the tribulation period. That's where there's going to be a limited nuclear exchange, and that's where I think the United States is going to be hamstrung by nuclear attack on us, but we're not going to be annihilated, but it will catapult the world into this tribulation period, and it will catapult the Antichrist into prominence and into world dominance and to world power. And the whole world, because there's a limited nuclear exchange and a quarter of mankind is wiped out within the first few weeks or first few months of the tribulation period, everybody's going to be screaming for one world government and one world leader. Yeah, Lord.
Did you say Iran or the Arab countries would join up with Russia?
Yes. If you read that...
I thought it was they would join up with Egypt.
No. Well, Egypt will probably be there with them, along with the Arab nations. But that's the very beginning of the tribulation period. Remember when we went through Ezekiel. You read Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. It specifically says Persia, which is modern-day Iran. Mm-hmm. And plus all of these other Arab nations... And these other countries will go up against Israel in an attempt to, drive her into the sea. But what's described there, in my opinion, is the neutron bomb, which will be used extensively by the Israelis, and that an act of God will cause earthquakes and everything else, and they will all turn on each other.
I see. I'm sorry.
And they will wipe each other out, basically, except a very small minority will live through that. That's at the very beginning of the tribulation period. That's what I think this is referring to here. It's not referring to the Battle of Armageddon, because that comes 7 years later. Mm-hmm. Then he says here, in verse 41, he will also enter the beautiful land, which is Israel. And many countries will fall, and these will be rescued out of his hand. Edom, Moab, the foremost sons of Adam. In other words, Edom, if you look at... Excuse me, what?
You said Adam. It's Ammon.
Ammon, I'm sorry. If you look at the map, it's modern-day Saudi Arabia, that he will end up getting control over these nations down there that have basically a monopoly on oil. Then he says here in that verse 42, he says, then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. And, anyone who he's just going to turn on everybody, who opposes him. Mm-hmm. And then in verse 43, he says, but he will gain control over the hidden treasures and gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt and Libya, and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. In other words, he's going to have complete and total control over the oil reserves of the world. Mm-hmm. Okay, this guy, there's going to be no stopping this guy. And then verse 44, but rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many, and he will pitch his tents of the royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful and holy mountain, and he will come to an end, and no one will help him. So I don't know, you can't see it this well on this map, but right here is the Dead Sea. He says he's between the seas. It's Jerusalem, the Dead Sea, and the Mediterranean Sea. He's going to pitch his tent. In other words, he's going to make his last stand there in Jerusalem. This is at the end of the world. This is the Battle of Armageddon. When it says here, the rumors of the east, we are told in John, the revelation in John, that he said that 200 million men from the kings of the east will march across the dried up Euphrates River, and they will converge there, in the Valley of Megiddo, which is otherwise known as the Valley of Decision, the Valley of Armageddon, the Valley of Armagog. They will all meet there. There will be 200 million men from the east there. There will be hundreds of millions from the west. It says in Joel that there will be multitudes in the Valley of Decision. I mean, I don't want to read the whole thing, but in Joel, I think it's very interesting that Joel had said that he prophesied something like 400 years before Christ. He said that the day of the Lord is coming. Surely it is near, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. As the dawn is spread over the mountains, so there is a great and mighty people. There has never been anything like it, nor will there ever be again after it. To the years of many generations, it says the fire consumes before them, and behind them a flame burns. In other words, they're describing nuclear destruction. A land is like the Garden of Eden before them, and desolate wilderness behind them. In other words, they're running from the destruction. It says their appearance is like the appearance of horses and the war horses. So they run with the horse with a noise of chariots. They leap on the top of mountains like the crackling of a flame of fire consuming the stubble. In other words, to me, it's describing modern day warfare, modern day war machines, helicopters and gunships and these type of things that are all going to be involved. And then he goes on to further say, he says, before then the earth quakes, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness. And he goes on to describe how there'll be multitudes in the Valley of Decision. I mean, you won't be able to count them all. There'll be multitudes, umpteen millions of men down there in this last battle of the war. And we are told in John and Revelations that when all of these armies are converged down there, battling it out, the sun's already nova, the world is plunged in pitch darkness, the moon has become blood red, and you see Christ coming back in the clouds. Mm-hmm. With a multitude of the saints with him riding on a horse, the Antichrist and these armies that are killing each other down there see Christ coming, and they actually turn their guns on him, because we are told that in Revelation that he wages war against Christ. and they start firing on Jesus Christ coming back, and you know, in this great power, great glory, and other people that are seeing Christ coming back, if they're not right with Christ, they're going to be saying to the mountains and the hills, fall upon us, hide us from the face of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. I mean, they're going to know, hey man, this is it. We have rejected him, we have despised him, we spit upon him, we ignored him, and here he comes. You know, all of these years that we have done nothing but give our middle finger to him, here he comes. And they are going to be terrified. They're going to be so terrified, they're going to be pleading for the mountains and the rocks to fall on him, crush him into oblivion, and just, you know, be oblivion, because they just don't want to face this judgment that's coming. Well, when Christ comes back, he said his feet are going to come back and right back on the Mount of Olives where he left. There's going to be a great earthquake. He's going to split right from the Mount of Olives, right through the East Gate. That's where he's going to walk through. He's going to go walking right up to the Antichrist. We are told in the book of Habakkuk that the Antichrist is going to be split from the very neck down to his thigh. He's going to split wide open, him and apparently the false prophet. But then we are told in Thessalonians, and we are told in other places of Scripture, that he's going to be thrown alive into the lake of fire. We are told that very specifically in Revelation. So in other words, he's going to be the first fruits of the resurrection of the damned. After he is slain by the breath of Christ, Christ is going to raise him up right there, and then he's going to be thrown alive into this lake of fire. And him and the Antichrist, and him and the false prophet will be in the lake of fire for 1,000 years. They will be his sole occupants until 1,000 years are up, and then all of hell is thrown into the lake of fire along with the devil and death and everything and Hades and everything else. But when Christ comes back, you have these hundreds of millions of men down there that have turned their guns on him. It says that he just speaks the word, expunges every last drop of blood out of their veins, and it causes a river of blood to flow for 200 miles, virtually the whole length of Israel, that's as high as a horse's bridle. So you talk about carnage. You talk about, you know, where truth is stranger than fiction. This is it. But anyway, just it says that in verse 45, he will pitch his tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountains, yet he will come to an end, and no one will help him. Once Christ comes back, he's going to do him in. Nobody's going to come to his aid. All right? So when we that's the conclusion of this chapter 11. Like I said, it's a very heavy chapter. The last portion of this deals with the end times. The first 35 verses or so was, you know, dealing with all the things that have already taken place. They've already taken place before Christ was born. All right. Now we get into the final chapter of Daniel, which is only 13 verses. Does anybody have any questions or anyone want to ask before we go on? Huh? Okay. Well, okay. Let's start with this chapter 12 now. We'll just finish this book up for tonight. And it says, because the angel is still speaking to Daniel, okay, through all these different chapters, through chapter 10, 11, and 12. Beginning with verse 1, chapter 12 says, now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise, and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book of life, will be rescued. Now, look what he says in just that verse 1. I mean, it's a mouthful. He says, he's talking to Daniel, the angel's talking to Daniel, he says, now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people. In other words, I've said this many times, and when you read especially this chapter, when we went through the chapter 10 in Daniel, we see that God has angelic beings over every single nation on earth. And it's my contention that the devil has demonic beings over every single nation on earth. And God has specifically entrusted Michael the archangel to be the one over Israel. And I believe the devil himself has not delegated that nation to any other demonic spirit. I believe that he himself is over Israel. Look what's happening in Israel today. Look at all the bloodshed. Look at all the killing. Look at all the mayhem. You know, any rational person will just sit there and scratch their head and say, what is the problem here? What is wrong with these people? Well, I'm telling you, they don't see that there's a demonic force behind all this. And the devil himself is the one who's really influencing. He's right there. He's having people blow themselves up, thinking that they're going to go to heaven with 72 virgins, and they're going to have, you know, one big orgy for all eternity. I mean, where do these people come up with this cockamamie stuff? It's the devil got them so blind and so flim-flam with all this convoluted reasoning, and that they killing each other left and right, killing themselves. And you think, what is wrong? I mean, any rational person would see this, the lunacy of this. but you don't. They don't see the spiritual forces behind this. There's Michael the Archangel. He's the one that's guarding over Israel, and the devil is the one who's trying to destroy Israel because he sees just how important this nation is, and he hates Israel with a passion. I mean, he just hates the Jews with an utter contempt. He hates all men. He hates all nations. But with the Jews particularly, he hates them with an infernal malice that just defies all human comprehension. And the reason he hates them so much is because it's through the Jews that salvation has come to the world. It's through the Jews that Jesus Christ was born. It's through the Jews that we have received the Ten Commandments. It's through the Jews that we have received God's Word. It's through the Jews that the world has been saved. That's why he holds them in such contempt. That's why there's so much violence right there in the Middle East. Not too many people can see behind the veil. They're just seeing people killing each other left and right, but they're not seeing what's being orchestrated behind the scenes. They're not seeing that this demonic monster behind the scene using these people like puppets on a string to do his bidding for them. Mm-hmm. You know? So when we're reading this chapter 12, it's almost as though it's very important that we read a portion of the Revelation in chapter 10. I don't want you to turn there. I just want to read you Revelation chapter 10 because I believe that the angel that is described in Revelation chapter 10 is the same being that's being described here as Michael the Archangel in chapter 12 of Daniel, because it says in Revelation chapter 10, "And I saw another strong angel coming down out of heaven, clothed with a cloud, and the rainbow was upon his head, and his face was like the sun, and his feet were like pillars of fire. And he had in his hand a little book which was open, and he placed his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land. And he cried out with a loud voice as when a lion roars. And when he had cried out, the seven peals of thunder uttered their voices. And when the seven peals of thunder had spoken, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying, Seal up the things which the seven peals of thunder have spoken, and do not write them. And the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land lifted his right hand to heaven." Okay, this is what John is seeing here as far as this angel. He's got one foot planted on the sea and one foot planted on the earth. I believe that this angel is Michael the Archangel. I could be wrong. I don't want to be dogmatic about it, but I really believe that it is Michael the Archangel, especially when you tie it in with this chapter 12 of Daniel. And, you know, he's clothed with a cloud, and I think the cloud shows that there's a mystery to this being, but also how a cloud's formed. Clouds are formed when the warm, moist air hits the cold air from up above. It forms clouds. And I believe that this angel has come from the warmth of heaven down to the frigid coldness of earth as far as the spiritual condition is concerned, and it forms this cloud around this angel. But he's got one foot on the sea and one foot on the land, and his feet are a flame of fire, showing that he's standing in judgment, claiming the earth back for God. And he's raising his right hand with a book in his hand, okay, in his left hand. Then it says here, in that verse 6, he says, "And he swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created the heavens and the things in it, and the earth and the things in it, and the sea and the things in it, that there shall be no more delay. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, then the mystery of God is finished, as he preached to his servants of the prophets." It says the mystery of God is finished. In other words, this is kind of speculative, but the angel has a mystery about him. Is he covered in a cloud? When we read down here further, we read about this being who's over this river, who's dressed in linen.
When
we read further in Daniel, we will read that there's this angel that I believe is Michael standing over this Tigris River, and he's dressed in linen. And there's no mystery about him. In other words, what I believe is this. There's something suggested here. All of God's judgments to the unsaved are a mystery. In other words, they don't seem right. They don't seem just. They don't seem fair. But to the righteous person, to the saved person, to people in heaven, to the angels in heaven, all of God's judgments are righteous. But when it comes to earth and God mets out his judgments, it's a mystery to men. When we're dealing with all the judgments that come upon mankind during the tribulation period, to the righteous, to the saved, they're going to see God's righteousness in it. They're going to see God's holiness in it. They're going to see God's wisdom in it. They're going to see the poetic justice in it. But to the unsaved, they're just going to blaspheme God and see, you know, because they're not going to put two and two together. Anyway, I just want to conclude this with what I've read there in this chapter 10 of Revelation. Just continue on. It says here, in verse 8 of that chapter 10 of Revelation, he says, "And the voice which I heard from heaven, I heard again, speaking with me, saying, Go take the book which is open." Now, it's important. "Which is open in the hand of the angel who stands on the sea and on the land. And I went to the angel, telling him to give me the little book. And he said to me, Take it and eat it, and it will make your stomach bitter, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey. And I took the book out of the angel's hand and ate it, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And when I had eaten it, my stomach was made bitter. And he said to me, You must prophesy again concerning the many peoples and nations and tongues and kings." So the angel gave this little book to John, the Apostle John. John ate the book. It was as sweet as honey in his mouth. But then it became bitter and sour, and man, he really got a Maalox moment. I mean, he was really, really, in distress. And the angel said, "Now you must prophesy against many peoples, languages, and tongues." In other words, that's what God's word very often does. Too, it's very, very, I think, sweet to the saved. It's very palatable, and when you read God's word, we find it to be encouraging, inspiring, uplifting, edifying, and so many things. But then, at the same token, there is a word of judgment in this thing, and we are compelled to bring forth the good and the bad. In other words, we can't just say, "Well, God is love, and God is merciful, and God is kind, and God is all of these different things." There's another side to God's nature. Okay, that God is just, and God is holy, and God is righteous. And if we don't get right with Him, man, we're going to have hell to pay, literally. Mm-hmm. And people don't want to hear that, and quite frankly, it's not an easy thing to tell people, because people want to be told something that's going to tickle their ears. They want to be told, "Hey, you're basically a good person. Doesn't matter what you believe, what you do, and how you act. You'll get to heaven because you're basically good." That's what we want to hear. But that's the biggest claptrap, phony. That's just a lie, just expelled right out of the bowels of hell. And people are falling for it hook, line, and sinker because they don't want the truth. Go up to the person and say, "Hey, there's no good in you. You are a monster of iniquity, and you're on your way to hell unless you repent." Now say that to somebody, and they'll probably put a 2x4 to your head. But that's the truth. Anyway, let's get back to chapter 12 of Daniel. Well, I just read about this angel that came down to earth. Now, I believe this is the same angel that's being mentioned here in this chapter 12 when it says, "Now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands over guard over your people, will arise, and there will be a time of distress, the tribulation period, such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who was found written in the book of life, will be rescued." In other words, look what happened in the last century. Look what happened under Hitler. Look what happened under Stalin. Look what happened under the communists, under Pol Pot. And look, over 100 million people were massacred under communism. Well, that's a flash in the pan. That's nothing compared to what's coming. In verse 2, it says, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but others to disgrace and everlasting contempt." Now he jumps way ahead. In other words, he's mentioning something here that if Jesus Christ were to return tonight, this fulfillment of this chapter 2, or verse 2 rather, will not happen for another 1,000 years. I mean, this is a prophecy that really, spans the thousands of years, because he says here, "Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life." In other words, there's going to be a resurrection of the saved, and there's going to be a resurrection of the damned. There's four phases to the first resurrection. We read about the first resurrection in Revelation. The first resurrection is where the people who are saved. First phase is what?
Jesus Christ.
He is the first fruits of the resurrection. He was the first one resurrected from the dead. The second phase is what? The rapture, where God's people who have died since Christ's death on the cross, who have given their life to Him until His return in the clouds, if they're dead, their bodies are going to be reunited with their souls when they return with Christ. That's the second phase. The third phase is what? Anybody remember? The third phase is those who live through the tribulation period, who give their life to Christ during their tribulation period, and who are martyred for their faith in Christ. After Christ returns, literally, physically to the world, they will be resurrected, and they will rule and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. Then the final phase of the first resurrection is what?
Those who died during the 1,000-year
period. Those, not just die, but those who even are alive at the very end of the millennial period, they will not have a resurrected body. They will go into the millennial period with a fallen nature just like you and I.
Well, they have to have a resurrected body too. So those are the first; those are the four phases of the first resurrection. We are told anybody who's part of that first resurrection, they are blessed. But then the second resurrection is the resurrection of the damned, the resurrection of the dead. We are told in Revelations that the earth will give up its dead, the sea will give up its dead, and Hades will give up its dead. In other words, all the souls in hell, their souls will come up out of hell, be reunited with their bodies, whether they died in the sea or died on the land. And it doesn't matter whether they've been eaten by sharks or whether they've burned, been consumed, whether they've been cremated. It doesn't matter whether they're molding in the grave. All the atoms and molecules that make up their being are still in existence. Because that's the first law of thermodynamics, that matter cannot be created or destroyed. In other words, you take a log, throw it in a fireplace, you can consume it down to ashes, but all the molecules, the atoms that made up that log are still in existence. It's just been changed. So all Jesus Christ has to do is just like when he said, Lazarus, come forth. He just says, everybody come forth. Wham! All the molecules, atoms, whatever, that are still in existence come back together. They're resurrected. But this resurrection of the damned, they're going to stand before Christ on Judgment Day, the Great White Throne Judgment Day. And that will be 1,000 years from tonight, if he came back tonight. They will stand before him. They will stand before him naked. And there won't be any saved in that crowd. That is the judgment of the damned. Then everybody, great, small, who are standing before him, that will be judged. And they will be judged before the whole universe. This judgment is going to show, without any doubt, that God's judgments are right and true. Nobody's going to be in hell and saying, hey, man, I was framed. Hey, man, I shouldn't be here. You know, not like it is in prison where everybody's claiming to be innocent. No, everybody's going to see, hey, you belong there. You belong there. And they're going to know themselves, I belong here. God will not allow anybody in hell the luxury of saying, hey, I don't deserve this. You know, I've been framed. He will not allow them that luxury. Because everyone in hell, every damn demon in hell, is going to see them and say, hey, you belong here just like the rest of us. That's what this judgment is all about. And then he says here, in that verse 3, he says, and those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. In other words, those who have gone forth and have witnessed, have led other people to Christ. And believe me, you know, I've been a Christian, I'm going on 30 years now, and I don't know how many people I've witnessed to and how many people I've talked to over the years and how many times I've run into these brick walls and gotten nowhere in terms of trying to convert people to Christ. And it's really a frustrating thing. But I just have to leave the outcome in God's hands. And all I have to be concerned myself with is going out there and doing what God wants me to do in terms of trying to be a witness. I think it was St. Francis of Assisi who once said, preach the gospel at all times, and if necessary, use words. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very good. In other words, you know, you can go out there and preach the gospel without always trying to beat somebody over the head with it. He says here in that verse 4, says, but as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end times. Many will go back and forth and knowledge will be increased. In other words, many will travel to and fro and knowledge will be increased. But look what he says in that verse 4. But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal the book. Why does he use the two phrases, conceal and seal? He could have just said seal up the book or conceal the book. Why does he say that? Conceal means to hide. All right? In other words, the fulfillment of this, the understanding of this book, is going to be hidden until a certain period of time. But not only is it hidden, men are not going to be able to understand the fullness of this book, but it's sealed. In other words, not only is it hidden, but God's put a seal on it. Say, it's locked. You can't understand it. But that was in Daniel's time. Mm-hmm. Now in John's time, what's he got? He's got a little book in his hand, and it's no longer sealed. That book, John consumes and then prophesies. So in our day and age, it's no longer a sealed book. It's no longer a concealed book. The meaning could be understood, can be grasped. And he says this. What's going to happen? He says this. But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end times, to the last days. Many will go back and forth, or many will travel to and fro, and knowledge will be increased. There's a key for us right there. that there'll be a travel explosion, a knowledge explosion. Now, men have always said, well, people have always learned and they've always been traveling. You know, you really have to have your head buried somewhere where the sun don't shine if you believe that. In other words, it's been look at the past 100 years. We have gone from horse and buggy to the moon. And every time I get behind the wheel of a car and I'm trying to get from A to B in rush hour, I think, oh, gosh, Daniel was so right. People traveling to and fro, right?
Yeah.
Try to get on a plane, and you see planes taxiing and backed up 12 deep. Get on a train. Everywhere you go, buses, trains, as people are traveling all over this world and all over the place, aren't they? Back in the 17th century, you had Isaac Newton, who was a very, very brilliant scientist, who was also a very devout Christian, who knew his Bible backwards and forwards. He had a contemporary named Voltaire. Voltaire was an atheistic infidel. He was a godless man, a blasphemer. He mocked Christians all the time. Well, Isaac Newton had read this portion of Daniel, and he said, you know, in the last days, men must be going to invent some kind of machine that will enable them to travel about 35 miles an hour. And Voltaire, when he heard that, he said, see what fools Christianity makes out of otherwise brilliant men. He says, doesn't Isaac Newton know that if a man were to go 35, 40 miles an hour, that his heart would stop beating? Now, who's the fool?
Right.
See what I'm saying? I mean, when these guys are going to the moon, they were doing 25,000 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a travel explosion. And then he says here, well, knowledge will be increased. Every 10 years, knowledge is doubling.
Well,
everything that we know right now, everything that man knows right up to this point, from the beginning of history right up to this point, everything he knows, everything's going to be doubled 10 years from now, probably less than that.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more like 5 years, because it's accelerated mm-hmm. so much. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who can keep up with this? They're talking about this will be a time where there'll be a travel explosion and a knowledge explosion. Are we living in that time?
Yeah.
You have to be a complete fool to deny it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just on the knowledge thing, too. Anybody in this room, within 10 minutes, can find very fundamental things about anything. Just go into that computer,
right.
Get on the internet, type right. in what you're looking for, and
bingo.
Start
right.
reading about it.
30, 40 years ago, we wouldn't even conceive that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Then he says here in that verse 5, he says, Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others were standing on one side of the bank of the river and on the other side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be until the end of these wonders? Now, if we read back in chapter 10, we discover that the river is the Tigris River over there in Babylon, that this angel appeared to him. Well, Daniel is now seeing an angel over the river, which I believe is Michael, the same angel, and then an angel on each side of the river. And then keep something in mind. The river are in Scripture, symbolically, waters represent what?
People,
languages, nations, and tongues. Okay? So he says this in that verse 6. The one who said to the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long will it be until the end of these wonders? In other words, when is all this going to have its fulfillment? And verse 7, and I heard the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river as he raised his right hand, like we read in Revelation, as he raised his right hand and his left towards heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it would be a time, times, and half a time. And as soon as they finish shattering the powers of the holy people, all these events will be accomplished. So when the angel above the river is raising both hands, unlike this angel here, but again, he was raising both hands then because it was a sealed book. Now in Revelation, he's got one hand raised and one hand with an open book where John gets his books. In other words, there's a difference there. The fact that he's dressed in linen again shows God's righteous judgments, that from heavenly perspective, you can see the righteousness of God's judgments. From the earth's perspective, it's all a mystery. Okay. But he says here, how long will it be? A time, times, and half a time. So a time is a year. Then times, plural. There's an S at the end of the second time. So you got 1 year plus 2 years equals 3 years, then half a time, 3.5 years. So from the abomination of desolations till the Christ returns, there will be 3.5 years. Right? In mid-tribulation period, that's when he says this is going to take place. That... A time, times, and half a time.
Then it says this, then all this will be completed, that Christ will be returned. Then in verse 8 it says, as for me, I heard but could not understand. So I said, my Lord, what will be the outcome of these events? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for these words are concealed and sealed up until the end time. Again, he says it again, concealed and sealed. Till when? The end time. Are we living in end times? Yes. For one reason, we can understand it now. It's no longer concealed and it's no longer sealed. We know what's going on. Daniel didn't understand, even though he wrote this down. He couldn't comprehend. The angel said, go your way, Daniel. This is a sealed book. It's concealed. You're not going to understand it till the end times. Well, we understand it today. Showing again, we're in the end times. And it says here in verse 10, many will be purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand. Again, look at the situation. Okay? Many will be purged, purified, and refined. That's what happens when tribulation hits. That men become purified, refined. I mean, most men, as long as their lives are halfway satisfactory to themselves, they can't be bothered with God or the things of God. Oh, they'll give him the mental scent. They'll give him the sloppy sentimentality. They'll give him the lip service. They'll go to church and mumble prayers. But God is not number one priority in their life. But put them on a sick bed, flat on their back, and they got nobody to look but up and nowhere to go but down on their knees. Then this has a purifying, purging effect, doesn't it? Because then all of a sudden, God becomes important. When, you know, the old adage, no atheists in foxholes, when death is very imminent, you know, God becomes a very, very important entity in you, as far as your life is concerned. But as long as you're counting your money and as long as you're having a good time, I mean, you know, God's far removed from your, you know, from your heart. See what I'm saying? This is why God will allow so much tribulation and so much distress and so much, you know, so much pain in the world. Because a lot of times, not only is it a judgment for sin, but it has a refining effect where it can lead men to God. Okay? Because most men won't choose God if their lives are halfway satisfactory to themselves. This is why when you look at the Great Tribulation period, there's going to be incredible destruction, incredible suffering and death and dying and, you know, misery. But when you look at it from a divine perspective, it's actually God's mercy. Because multitudes of people will be saved through all of this tribulation who would otherwise, if they are just allowed to go their merry old way, they end up damned for eternity because they didn't have anything to turn them around. Okay, so he says in verse, but he also says here that verse 10, he says, many will be purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand. In other words, there's also going to have another effect upon men. Look, there's always two types of people. Look at the thief on the cross, the two thieves. Okay, one of them, his sufferings led him to Christ. The other one did nothing but blaspheme, and he's probably blaspheming tonight. Mm-hmm. You know, suffering can also have a hardening effect on people. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is a bigger mystery than the suffering. But, again, you can see that when people are hell-bent on their wickedness, okay, it doesn't matter how much you slap them upside the head, they're determined to do it. Mm-hmm. It says here that the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand. In verse 11, and from the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. But as for you, go your way to the end. Then you will enter into the rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the age. Now he says something very unique in that verses 11 and 12. He says, and from the time of the regular sacrifice is abolished, that's the abomination of desolations. Okay? That's 3.5 years in the tribulation period. He says, and the abomination of desolations is set up, there will be 1,290 days, which is 3.5 years.
Right.
God gives it to us in years. He gives it to us in months. He gives it to us in days. Now, don't make no mistake about it. You know, you got these fools that are running around saying, well, you know, the world's been around for 10 billion years. Our solar system's been around, and our world has been 5 billion years old. Hey, that's all a bunch of hooey. Okay? God's timetable is the same here as it has always been. Mm-hmm. All right? What I'm saying here, this doesn't mean, well, it could be billions and billions and billions of years. No. It means that this is 3.5 years. He gives it to us in months. He gives it to us in years. He gives it to us in days. Mm-hmm. So we make no mistake about it that from the abomination of desolation till Christ returns, it's going to be 3.5 years. All right? Then he says something kind of interesting. He says that verse 12, how blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. So you got another, almost like another 45 days that are added to after Christ's return. So what does he mean by that? This is what's suggested. When Christ comes back, the world's going to be totally ruined. Totally. I mean, we are told in Zephaniah that it's going to be so destroyed. First of all, the sun is nova. Okay? All the fresh water's turned to blood. The seas have turned to blood. All the trees have been burned up. All the green grass has been burned up. I mean, the world has been, you know, shaken to pieces through a global earthquake, where the earth is actually knocked off its axis, and it begins to sway to and fro like a hammock, just like it says, and I predicted in Jeremiah and Isaiah, where every building in the world is going to come down, every mountain is going to be moved out of its place, every island is going to be moved out of its place. I mean, everything's going to be shifted. I mean, the whole world is going to look like a war zone. The whole world is going to be so destroyed. So when Christ comes back, it's like, in Zephaniah, he says that Christ is going to remove all things, men and beasts and everything. He's going to remove it and recreate it to set up his millennial kingdom. Okay? And also in that period of time, we are told in Matthew 24 that's when Jesus is going to separate the sheep from the goats. There's going to be a judgment. It's not going to be the same, you know, great white throne judgment, but there will be a judgment at the end of the age where he says, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was a stranger, I was in prison. What did you do for me? Those are the people on the right. He's going to say to them, hey, come into my father's. In other words, they are the ones who are going to go into his millennial kingdom. The ones on the left, or the goats, he's going to say, hey, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was in prison. And what did you do? And they're going to say, oh, God, man, if we'd known it was you, we would have done something about it. And he says, hey, you're cursed, you know, get out of here. See what I'm saying? So there's going to be over a month period of time where everything's going to be renewed. So he says, blessed is he who attains to that 1,335 days, and then he goes into the millennial kingdom, you know, when Christ rules and reigns for 1,000 years. And then he says in that verse 13, but as for you, go your way to the end, then you will enter into rest again and rise again to your allotted portion at the end of the age. So he tells Daniel, you don't understand this, just write it down. Okay, and then you're going to die, but at the end of the age, you're going to be resurrected. Okay, and be given your allotted portion or be given your reward. Mm-hmm. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?